to the Reformed Dissenters. That's us. We're the show where Reformed Christians dissent against popular ideas of culture by asserting a biblical worldview. I'm Bruce Johnson, joined, of course, and as always, by my brother Jacob Johnson.
Hello, everybody.
And today is, we're back to our regularly scheduled program. That is much harder to say than it sounds. We are talking about Dr. Joe Rigney's book, Leadership and Emotional Sabotage, on this year, Literature Friday. Welcome to Literature Friday, everybody. The subtitle to this book gives it all away, so I won't be reading it till the end. Just kidding. Resisting the Anxiety That Will Wreck Your Family, Destroy Your Church, and Ruin the World. He just comes out swinging on this one. So if you missed the last two episodes with Dr. Rigney's book, or Dr. Rigney himself, who was on the show last week or the week before, you are missing stuff, which should be obvious given the statement, but it's stuff that you're going to want to see. So, you should be in the state of not missing as opposed to where you currently are, which is a very, am I over explaining this? No, you're currently in a state of missing things.
Are in a current state of missing things, because there could be people who are up to date.
Yes. So if you're in that, go back and rewatch. If you're not, continue. Wow, this was fun. We should do this again sometime. So today we're reading chapters 2 and 3 in this book, of which hopefully you're not missing any other chapters from. So yeah, this will be fun.
But if you are missing,
no. Here we go.
And we're back.
That chapter 2 is be sober minded or else. Chapter 3 is sabotage is coming. It's a coming, everybody. So you should definitely grab a copy of this book yourself if you haven't already. You can go to Canon Plus Press, canonpress.com press. That's the one. I think there's also a book, Leadership. Maybe it's emotionalsabotage.com or something like that. It's linked in the Dr. Rigney episode, yeah. So check that out. But before we get into all that, we have to do what we always do, which is talk about our verse of the week. Friday means Jacob does that, not me. So, Jake, what is our verse and why is this so important?
Our verse this week is Romans 1, verses 20 through 21. And they say, "For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and his divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened." And this is an amazing quote. I think this is pretty great, especially when we're talking about natural law. Hopefully some people have heard of that phrase before, natural law, but for those who don't, it has multiple different meanings. So if you look up a definition, you probably will not get the same definition as what other people would say it is. So I take this specifically how this verse states it. And basically this verse is speaking about natural law. And so I take what natural law means to be what this verse is describing. And that is basically that everybody knows God, right? They know him because guess what? They were created in God's image. They know him. And that's practically what, at least natural revelation is what other people call it as well. So, but really, what we're saying, and I go as far as to say, this first section of verse 20 is what we're really looking at here when we're talking about this, with this natural law of what's the point? What is the point of knowing God, of all these people knowing God, right? It's so that they are without excuse, right? It's not so they can create a law or they can create their own law out of the earth, right? Well, this feels natural to me, so this must be natural law, right? No. No. Natural law is not something that we base truth off of, right? It's saying here, this natural law or natural revelation is what we use, right? So that the people who, you know, of course, you've probably, if you're in the world and you talk with people who are in the world, there will be people who use the argument of, well, you know, what about those people in Africa that have never heard of Christianity or the Bible? Do they still go to hell? Do they still, are they still punished by the same standard of the people who have heard? And this verse is saying, yeah, because they do know God. Because of his power, his creation of the world. It's, you look at the world and you have to say that there is a creator, right? So what this is saying is that this natural law, this thing that is in nature, right? God's engineering in the works, his world, points us to God, but it shouldn't be used to understand the will of God.
Hmm.
We have a book. We have a book that tells us what the will of God is. So we don't need to use the earth to tell us what the will of God is. We don't need this nature to tell us what the will of God is. We have literally God's law, his will to us, his instructions to us as to what his will is to us. So I think this verse 20 is perfect for describing that, in the fact that so that they are without excuse. What's the point of natural law? What's the point of us understanding that there is this nature, God's nature, in all the world? It's so that they are without excuse. So.
Amen. Dude, brilliant breakdown. This is a conversation that's come up many times in many ways. Merry Christmas. It's something, because I think it's, especially with Stephen Wolfe's book being recently released, and with with Thomas Aquinas's ideas being, you know, breathed new life into, this has come up a lot. So it's good every once in a while, I think, to reset and say, wait a minute, what do we actually believe about this natural law stuff? And what better way to do that than to find a passage that also, on the advent of Life Month, but also the heathens celebrated defeat, ultimately, of their own defeat that they're celebrating this month, their own pride, which goes before their fall. They need to hear this passage as well. So we are getting into chapters 2 and 3, and I'll be getting into chapter 2. Jake will be getting into chapter 3. Haha. There's so much here. If you missed the past couple episodes, I'll just really quickly recap in less than 3 minutes. One of the biggest things about this book, something to wrap your mind around, is the concept of degree. And Edwin Friedman, that's his name, is someone who wrote some very, very thought-provoking and emotionally intentional books, or works of literature, not literature, but academic papers, basically, on the idea of therapy, helping people through crises and different things like that. Specifically addressing their emotions, he did write a book called A Failure of Nerve, Leadership in the Age of the Quick Fix. But Mr. Edwin Friedman is not a Christian. He's a Jew. And so you can only take what he says with a grain of salt. So Dr. Igney, who really likes his book and his thoughts and ideas, decided, hey, let's Christianize this. Let's take that area for Christ too, because that belongs to Christ as well. And the Bible has much, much more to say than some random person, even though they've dedicated their whole lives to it. God created that person and all the knowledge that he managed to somehow accumulate. So let's go to the Bible for answers. And so one of the first things that we addressed when we were walking through his chapter, one of the first things Dr. Rigney addressed was the idea of degree and how important degree is. And that's really talking about the structure of the universe, the structure of everything. There is an order, there's a hierarchy, and there needs to be. Otherwise, planets go off kilter, music becomes disharmonized, and everything gets wonky. And so that kind of brings us up to the precipice of everything is collapsing because we lack this. But what is degree? How do we recognize it? How do we possess it? How do we do that rightly? And what does that actually practically look like? And so that's where chapter 2 comes into play. Be sober-minded or else. Quote, in the absence of gravity, planets wander to disorder. Untune the string of degree and hark what discord follows. That's setting up again why degree is so important. There's so much to this idea of structure and order. Our God is not a God of disorder, but a God of order, right? There's a reason why he's put certain structures in place. But then more than that, he has given each person in those structures a role, a way to act responsibly and irresponsibly, right? That's the inverse of that. If you were not paying attention, you're going to act irresponsibly. And there's a reason why those things exist. And so page 26, he says, in this chapter, we'll sketch the outlines of a threefold cure for this fever of lack of degree, of insanity. Organizing the prescription by three of the Ten Commandments, the fifth, the tenth, and the first. Degree at the human level has to do with ordered relationships. In other words, it has to do with asymmetry and hierarchy. In biblical terms, such concerns fall under the fifth commandment, honor your father and mother, end quote. We also see throughout the Bible, Ephesians, for example, further iterations on this idea of degree. We see husbands, wives, we see children, parents, we see slave, master, we see lots of relationships there. And their structures, orders, hierarchies, and what they're meant to do, and responsibilities, and all of that. That's a constant theme throughout Scripture, and it's kind of the reason why we have the fall in the first place, and Dr. Rigney talked about that in the first chapter. But there is constantly this idea of a head and a body. Head, body. Those two things go together. You don't want a body without a head. You don't want a head without a body. It's a little creepy either way, right? And so that's how it is in nature. We're talking about this natural law thing. Well, God built the world in such a way that there needs to be a head and a body, or things will go off the rails. And there's a really good quote about this. At the center of the complexities of these relationships, page 27, Dr. Rigney says, the body as a whole does not exist for its own sake, but for the sake of God's mission in the world. And the same could be said and is said about the head. Neither of them exist for the sake of themselves. Neither of them exist just to exist. There's a reason, there's a mission, there's a goal. And it's usually when that goal is lost sight of, when you're, you know, engrossed in yourself, or engrossed in your own ideas of what you want to make the world, or make your own part of the world for you, that's when things go off the rails. And spoiler alert, he ends this chapter by bringing everything back to the gospel, the full gospel, that is Christ being king over the entire world, right? And our mission given from our king is to disciple the entire world, to continue to take dominion of the entire world, which was what we were created for originally anyways, right? Page 28, he says, quote, the head organizes and orders the body for its purpose. He must know the body's purpose and keep the purpose in mind as he empowers the body with his presence. I stress the notion of presence because the head orients and directs the body the way that the earth orients and directs the moon. There's the image again, like a planet with its moon. A husband guides his home through his gravity. So, there's a lot there. I do want to move on from this idea of body and head to how the body and the head should govern or be governed or react to governorship being governed, or what to do, what the responsibilities of each are. And he moves into talking about thou shalt not covet, moves into talking about the 10th commandment, right? And he says, quote, beneath the well-ordered society lies the well-ordered soul. Here we move from the fifth commandment to the tenth, you shall not covet. That is, you must not give your desires free rein. You must order and govern your loves and appetites. Your passions and emotions must not lead you astray. The Bible regards sober-mindedness as a key element of Christian maturity and fundamental qualification for leadership. And he really brings the receipts on this one. Several passages, 2 Timothy, and then later on 1 Peter, where he brings out the fact that sober-mindedness is talked about a lot in Scripture. So often is sober-mindedness the key central premise to getting a lot of other things straightened out. So if you're not being sober-minded, things go off the rails pretty quickly. And he talks about how we can be drunk on more than just alcohol. Right? You think sober-minded. Oh, okay, don't get drunk. Right, don't do that. Getting drunk is a sin. So is getting drunk on your passions. So is getting drunk on your emotions. And this is, he actually, Dr. Rigney talked about this in his interview when we interviewed him 2 weeks ago on the show. And this was a big critical part of what he was addressing, was this idea of getting drunk on your passions. And he really pulls this out in this chapter. So if you were confused sitting there during the interview and you're like, ah, I'm losing it, go to chapter two. Because so much of what he addressed is also in chapter two in written form, and it might make more sense to see it or read it a second time. But he brings up the fact that anxiety and anger and those sorts of things cloud your vision. They make it harder for you to see the world as it is. You start to imagine things, and paranoia takes hold, and then you go off the rails, right? And that's letting your passions and your emotions control you and guide you, and not being sober-minded. And it's easy to identify it, but it's really hard to kill it, right? Mm. We can identify the cancer of a drunk mind, drunk on our anxieties and passions, but it's really difficult to make yourself sober again when you're so used to being hooked on those things. He says, what are passions? At the most basic level, they are our immediate and impulsive desires. And passions are brought up all throughout Scripture. Romans, 1 Peter, 2 Timothy, Ephesians, Titus, passions are addressed all over the place. And we need to avoid being conformed to those passions, right? But he says also things like dogged passivity. I'm very passive. I'm very passive. I don't let my passions run me. I'm a passive person. I let the world come at me, and I just react to it in calm ways. Well, he says, dogged passivity can also be a reactive passion. We're led by our passions both when we blow up and when we shut down, when we get aggressive, when we get passive aggressive. And then he says, when our passions are on a slow burn, and when they're vague and general, we often call them moods or attitudes. When we experience low-grade, low-term anger, we say we're frustrated. When we experience low-grade, long-term fear, we say that we're anxious or worried. When it's vague and unidentified sadness, we are depressed. When we roll it all together and say we are stressed, we do that too a lot of times. So he spent a lot of time talking about all the little hidden ways that we let our passions rule us. And we become people who are not sober-minded. We become people who are engrossed with ourselves to the extent that we don't even see it, right? We lack clarity of mind. We lack stability of soul. And it causes major, major issues. And so at the end, the goal is to be sober-minded. So now we've identified how to be a good leader, what we're looking for, the signs of a bad leader, what to avoid. When we see these things in ourselves, we should identify them and say, look, look, I'm not being sober-minded. This is very important that I do this, but how do we fix it? He spends the last two pages talking about that. You shall have no other gods before me. First commandment. That right there is key. That right there is the central point to killing the cancer of not being sober-minded, to not being restrained by your passions, putting that to death, not entertaining it, not letting it rule even a little bit. Thou shalt have no other God before me. Quote, if degree operates like gravity, then the triune God is the sun at the center of the solar system. It is his gravity, his weightiness, his glory that is the ballast in our boat. He is the stability of our times. Mm. So not to give the Sunday school answer, but how do we fix not being sober-minded? God. We fix it by not fixating on ourselves. We fix it by recognizing we are not the center of the universe. We are not the ones ultimately in control here. We are resting in the providence of God. He is ultimately in control. He is making all the decisions. Everything we do has been predestined to be done. And we rest in that. That's security. That's glory. It's magnificent to be able to rest in that. And that's what gives us clarity of mind. And so with that, I'll pass it over to Jake to talk about chapter 3.
Yeah, my kind of first like impressions about this chapter 3 is very, very good. I like the fact that it's quite practical. It talks about it's talking about the sabotage. So the beginning of the book is emotional sabotage. That's the title of the book, and he begins to talk about how our own emotions and our own passions can sabotage us, and how we need to be aware of that. But he's talking in this chapter about how they actually sabotage us. And he talks about more than just within do they sabotage us, but the outworld is trying to sabotage our emotions as well. So he starts out chapter 3 saying, "The cure for our fever is sober-minded leaders who are grounded in the glory of God and therefore possess clarity of mind, stability of soul, and readiness to act." End quote. I think this is perfect to set up this fact, because it ties off of how he ended his last chapter, chapter 2, speaking about us being sober-minded leaders. So he's saying this is how we cure this fever that is either within our culture or within our church or within our family or within ourselves. This is how we cure it, by being sober-minded. He continues on page 39 to say, "But the moment that you begin to cultivate mature, sober-minded leaders, you should expect sabotage, both from within and without," end quote. And, this is perfect for what I did just recently say that this sabotage is from within and without. He says that, and how the fact that when we start doing what we're supposed to be doing, we should expect sabotage. We should expect to be attacked for us doing God's will. We should expect that we will be attacked for trying to become sober-minded and trying to think clearly. Continuing on to page 40, where he actually explains how this sabotage is happening and why people are being sabotaged. Page 40, he says, "The world often uses name-calling to try to steer Christians. In this case, the sabotage is overt and obvious. Biblical names for this tactic include slandering, reviling, to resist it, we must learn how and why the tactic works." I want to go actually a quote behind this to explain a little bit more. He says also on page 40, just two sentences before the quote that I just read, "What do I mean by sabotage? Sabotage is an attempt to steer or derail you, to take you and your people off mission." That's the point of sabotage. And beautifully said, the fact of you have a mission in your life, and what the sabotage is trying to do is push you and veer you away from that mission, right? So remember, this is that mission is given to us by God, and they're trying to push us off of that by sabotaging our emotions. So also on page 40, down below, this is the last paragraph of the page. "There are two basic kinds of steering wheels, ugly labels for true things and ugly labels for false things. An example of the former is when Christians are called haters and bigots for condemning homosexuality. It's true that Christians condemn homosexuality, but the ugly label is meant to silence our witness by appealing to our desire for approval and acceptance and of approval and acceptance and our fear of ostracism and rejection," end quote. So he then goes on to explain the fact of wanting to desire approval. The desire of approval is not necessarily wrong. He speaks about the fact of having a good name, how the Bible talks about, here we go, in Proverbs 22:1, it says, a good name is to be chosen rather than riches, and favor is better than silver or gold. Again, that was Proverbs 22:1. So we should strive for having a good name, a good reputation. And that's, in a sense, an approval by other people, right? They're seeing that we have a good name, right? And that's a sense of approval. But the issue that this brings is when we desire that too much, and that becomes our driving factor. So when people say, how dare you say that homosexuality is wrong, you know, you're going to get canceled for that, or we don't like that. Then you change, like, oh, no, oh, the people are running away. Oh, no, I should follow them because I want their approval. You're receiving approval from the wrong people. But also, that shouldn't drive you. Should be the drive that, no, God says homosexuality is wrong, so therefore homosexuality is wrong.
Hmm.
He then goes on to talk about the sin of empathy, which is very, very fascinating. I have a quote later on about it, but please read the beginning part. I don't have a quote on the beginning part where he kind of explains it. But to give a brief synopsis of that, he talks about the fact of it's good to have empathy, right? We just can't give full charge to empathy. He brings up Romans 12:15, which says, weep with those who weep and rejoice with those who rejoice. It's good to have the feelings of other people, to share those feelings, share those emotions, but not let that take charge. Same, it was the same thing with the desire for approval. A lot of this stuff is, you know, we need to have a balanced view. We can't let it, and like Bruce said, we have no other gods before me, right?
Mm.
Not let anything else take full control. The desire for approval is good as long as it's understood within a biblical principle. If it's taken as a god, right, as your full thing, then that's wrong. Same thing with empathy. Having empathy for people is good. Having too much empathy is wrong. Making that your goal, making that your god, that's wrong. To continue on page 42, he says, empathy, like all passions, is meant to be governed by what is true and what is good. It's meant to be tethered to reality. But in a crisis of degree, empathy is often a disguise for anger and reactivity. It frequently becomes a power tool in the hands of the sensitive. It's the means by which the most immature, reactive, and invasive members of community hijack the agenda and derail the mission. They do this by demanding that the rest of the community adapt to them and their sensitivities. I remember reading or listening. If you guys are very interested in this book, and especially with what Joe Rigney says in this book, please go to Canon Plus. He has a series on Canon Plus about talking about the things in this book. But I do believe it's still called Emotional Sabotage, right, Bruce? Am I right about that?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah. And it's him talking with Doug Wilson, and they go over a lot of Friedman's fables, which are very, very good, especially with how they explain them and show how their relevance. So I think that's something, if you really want to get further into this and know more about this stuff, that's really, really good to listen to. But he continues on about empathy, which I'm not going to go into greater detail into. I'm going to continue on. I only have two more quotes left, and that will be it. But to continue on with his next section, which says strengthening our nerve. And he says on page 46, first, take responsibility for yourself, your emotions, and your actions. Don't shift the blame. That's what maturity fundamentally is taught. That's what maturity is fundamentally, is taking responsibility for oneself. I'll continue on with the next quote, because I think this one also really speaks to this well. Again, page 46, just a little further down. The world operates according to a zero-sum notion of responsibility. If one person is 100% responsible, then everyone else must be zero responsible. If one person's responsibility increases, then everyone else's must necessarily decrease by the same amount. Such a mentality fuels blame shifting, since we believe that the sin of other people excuses our own. But this is false. We are not guilty for the sins of other people, but neither do their sins excuse ours. It still matters, like, your sin still matters whether someone has more sin than you. Sin is sin, right? It doesn't matter to how much degree each person has it. Each one, if there is fault by each person, then there's fault. I think a good example of this is if, and this is a very toned down example, and especially within children's lives, right? If you get mad, or if your brother gets mad at you, but you're the one who poked him and prodded him and pushed him into that, then you have sin for pushing that, for tempting that, and he has sin for getting angry. You are not let off the hook because he's the one who got angry, because he had the bigger outburst of sin. You're both at fault. And I think Christian parents do a decently good job of this, of saying, hey, you're wrong for getting angry, but you're also wrong for provoking it. So I think that's a good example to kind of explain what he's talking about there. But in a sense, the maturity is taking blame or understanding how much at fault you are and taking responsibility for that and either apologizing or what that entails. That is all I have. I really think chapter 3 is very insightful, especially when it comes to practicality of what this actually looks like on a daily life as to how we should expect this sabotage to come at us. But there's a lot more of chapter 3, actually, and I was not able to get to it. So please go read the chapter for yourself and continue on past what I was specifically talking about.
Yes, it's a great chapter, very practical. Thank you, Jake, for breaking that down. Thank you all in the audience for listening or listening to us or watching us today. Thank you, Dr. Rigney, for writing such an awesome book and giving us such great content to learn from and apply to our lives. We hope to see you all in the audience on Wednesday when we are back to talk about current events once again from a biblical perspective. Until then, have a wonderful rest of your weekend. Have a wonderful Lord's Day. And remember, everyone, in all that you do, do it as unto the Lord.